Appropriately enough, in our program, we move into a discussion with Pavan Dhingra. Pavan is joining us. He's the author of a book that I've found very fascinating. It's entitled Hyper Education: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. Pavan, first of all, good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the title of that book, I'm always curious about this with authors, was that the original title?
It was. I mean, I didn't set out with a title and then kind of write the book. I was writing the book, I realized this is what I'm hearing, right? I'm hearing, in effect, the parents are saying, we need more education than what our schools are providing us. And what was striking about that is that these are families who are in some of the highest ranked school districts of their state, and their children are doing just fine in school. They're not behind, they're not in any way, they're not, you know, gifted, they're just doing well. And they're very young. These were second graders, fifth graders. And they're saying, our kids need more academic content. They need to be pushed more than what the school is providing. And this can be fascinating. It can be stressful. It can be educational. And actually, it's all of these things. And one of the challenges is that one of the reasons why it matters is that it in effect creating an education arms race for our younger and younger kids. Where you have to be doing more out of school, outside of school, in order to be seen as smart and competent and high achieving. And so why it matters is that it's impacting obviously the students who are doing this, but it's impacting those who aren't doing it as well, who may not see themselves as competent or as strong as they actually are, because other students are getting ahead. And so it's a growing trend, and that's what kind of led me to the idea of hyper-education.
Now, Pavan, does that just heighten anxiety?
It is. In fact, there's already a growing trend before our pandemic, and now it's just going to increase. And so I can say that with some confidence, because right now parents are homeschooling their kids, and you're seeing like an increase in purchases of academic books because they're saying, well, our kids aren't getting enough homework, or our kids are they're given assignments that are due for the week, but they finish it early. I need to just give more stuff to my kids. And so parents are maybe for the first time increasingly not trusting that the schools are giving their children enough reading, writing, arithmetic. So they're taking it on their own hands. Well, this is what I'm talking about, right? Why are parents who are perfectly fine schools not satisfied and seeking more education, which contributes to, you know, educational inequality, the growing privatization of schools, because many of these families are seeking these educational supplements through, you know, private companies or through coaching or something else. And again, just to be clear, I'm not talking about extreme families, right, that are so intense in education that they're like you would look at them as, you know, crazy. This is a growing middle class trend that we're seeing that I think because of our pandemic is just going to grow and become even more entrenched.
How do we rein that in?
Well, that's the $1 million question, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe $1 billion question, because it's a $1 billion industry of tutoring. And I think we're going to realize that this is not necessarily always a bad thing, right? Parents seeking more for their kids is what parents do. And so what I think we need to recognize is that why parents are doing this sometimes has legitimate reasons, like their kids just really love certain academic subjects and the parents want to encourage what the kids love, and that makes sense. But what we do want to rein in is a sense of, I need to do this even though my kid may not like it, because otherwise my kid will be outcompeted by another child, right? And that's what we want to have a conversation around. Do we want an education system where parents feel they have to always be outcompeting the person, not just, you know, across town, but also right next to them? And the domino effect this creates is one that teachers I spoke to are feeling this, you know, I'm seeing more anxiety, I'm seeing more stress, I'm seeing a lot of self-doubt, a lot of lack of confidence in students. And yet parents, on the other hand, are saying, if we don't do this, if we don't invest in this kind of education for our kids outside of school, then they worry their kids won't be able to take advantage of opportunities down the road. They won't get into selective colleges that maybe not even the Ivy, just but selective colleges overall. And they could be putting their kids at risk. So the real challenge here, right, which is why it's a $1 billion question, that on the one hand, you have teachers, you know, looking out for kids and worrying about the stress and the competition. Their parents, on the other hand, saying, if we don't do this, our kids could be at risk for, you know, lack of confidence or lack of opportunities. And this is a challenge we have to start addressing through more communication through parents and teachers by asking ourselves as the public, what kind of education system do we want? Right? That's, I think, the way forward.
Well, isn't the real goal, though, one of the goals, the idea of trying to create a sense of learning being a lifelong process for kids?
That's an excellent question, and I'm glad you asked that, because one of the concerns that educators have around this growth of having kids in more education outside of school is that children will come to see learning, not just school, as a chore to do, just like I have to, like, you know, make my bed and take out the trash, instead of enjoying the process of learning, instead of at least finding it to be inspiring to some degree, right? And then if that becomes the case, right, children just see learning as an activity they have to get done because you have to, you know, get more worksheets or you have to study this or that, then the long-term impacts could be quite problematic. One is, as you're saying, right, they don't appreciate learning as its own kind of activity. Other impacts can be, you know, lack of creativity, lack of compassion. Like, I don't mean that these kids are not compassionate. They're very compassionate kids. But my point is that if we think about education as simply, right, trying to create competitive children to take the next level, to get to the next stage, then what are we not teaching them, right? And I think if anything, this COVID-19 moment has taught us is that, you know, compassion for your neighbor is something that we should be really thinking deeply about. Compassion for people you don't know, right, is something we really should be highlighting and stressing for all of us. And again, I'm not saying these families are anyway not that. They are. In fact, they're very well-meaning. They're very caring. They're nice people. They're well-grounded, right? But if we think about education and just in a competitive way, then what are we losing out on, right? That's the concern that you bring up, which I think is a very real one.
Do you think the pandemic could prompt a new approach to education in this country?
I would like to say yes, but I'm not optimistic about that, right? So in a sense, the reason why I would like to say yes is that, you know, we talk about education as something where we're obviously instilling, you know, academic competency in the students, but we also say, you know, schools are at the front lines of social emotional well-being. They're feeding kids. They're doing so much more than just the ABCs, right? And yet teachers are rarely assessed, right, in those other things that they're expected to do. And the assessment of teachers is very much about, you know, standardized testing and the like. And I don't want to weigh in on that per se. My only point is we can't really expect education to change in a fundamental way if the ways in which we measure outcomes doesn't also change, right? And the incentives, therefore, don't change. And also, the parents who do this have other motivations beyond just making sure their kids are academically competitive, which actually really surprised me. So, for example, when I ask parents, why do you do this? Why do you have your kid in an after-school math class? Why do you have your kid preparing for an academic competition, like, you know, a math or spelling competition? Mm-hmm. They would say, oh, man, my kid enjoys this, or I want them to be better prepared, more competitive, those kinds of things. But when I ask them, what do you worry will happen if you don't do this? Or what do you think of those families who don't do it? Then they revealed other motivations that were not just about making their kids smarter, but about making the kids more moral, better children. So in a sense, right, these parents are doing this because they think it not only creates more qualified kids, but more well-grounded and culturally appropriate kids. And I'll give you an example. I was talking with one mother who had her children in an after-school math class, and she was saying, you know, as we're talking about it, she said, you know, listen, my grandmother survived the Holocaust. My parents put me through college because they worked hard. I have my kids in this after-school math class, so I want them to understand the values of hard work, understand how they have to kind of grow as people. So that has nothing to do with, you know, being better at math or outcompeting your peers, right? That's also what she wanted, you know, but it has something to do much more than that. And this is one of the reasons why this is going to be a practice that's going to grow as opposed to diminish over time. And I was very surprised by that, but I heard a lot of stories like that. About kind of what it does for kids on a moral grounds compared to just the academic grounds.
What was your reaction when you heard that the national spelling bee, the Scripps National Spelling Bee, had been canceled?
I was, you know, very sad for the students because I spoke to a lot of the contestants and past champions of the Spelling Bee, as well as other academic competitions, and you hear from them, and they really enjoyed not just, you know, they enjoyed winning, right, or just, you know, doing well, but the actual being in D.C. for the Scripps National Spelling Bee is its own kind of excitement for them. And if they can make it on ESPN, because the finals are broadcast on ESPN, if they can make it to the ESPN stage, that's like a highlight of life, right, of any youth life. So any sports fan like myself would love that too. So I felt sad for the kids, but at the same time, my advice is maybe ironically, don't stop studying. And I don't mean that you have to just, you know, prepare for the next a competition that isn't happening. My point is, if you stop studying just because the competition is now canceled, then what does that say about why you were studying in the first place? It suggests that the only reason you were studying was to, you know, win the trophy, as opposed to you actually enjoyed what you were doing. Yes, you found value in the process. I make it akin to the Little League World Series, which is in August, right? Like, if that gets canceled, you don't want the kids who are going to be playing that to stop playing baseball in the backyard. You want them to still, you know, toss the ball around, play catch, you know, enjoy getting to the field. And the same thing here, right? We should just stop the idea of enjoying what you enjoying what you did around the Spelling Bee or the Geography Bee, which is another one that got canceled, or the math competitions. Realize what you enjoyed about it and try to do, you know, get back to that, in other words.
Why are first-generation Asian-American kids overrepresented in these academic competitions, such as the Scripps National Spelling Bee?
That's something also I speak to, which is that these kids are from parents who were able to migrate to the U.S. because, for the most part, not always, they got extremely high educations in their home countries and did very well in seizing opportunities for mobility. And that's what got them to the U.S. So they're not only highly educated relative to their peers back in their home countries in Asia, but they're actually oftentimes highly educated relative to their peers here. And that takes an incredible amount of dedication. And so if that's how you were able to make upward mobility, then it makes sense to you as a parent to say, well, this is what we have to help our kids do so that they also have upward mobility, or at least, you know, don't have downward mobility, don't go down in terms of their, you know, income status compared to us, the parents. And so you're going to be emphasizing education at a young age, which then facilitates, right, this success in academic competitions. And for a lot of the families, the U.S.-born white families I spoke to, they said the same thing. They said, you know, we moved to, for instance, the East Coast from the Midwest, and we got good jobs here. And that's because, you know, our parents and we really stress education. And so for my own kids, I want to do the same thing. And so you're seeing this commitment that a lot of parents have, but these families are finding ways to invest in it in ways other families often aren't. But again, I want to stress that this is not like an extreme kind of practice. So some of the math centers I'm talking to are like Kumon and Mathnasium as an example, right? Mm-hmm. And these are some of the fastest growing companies in the country, not just educational companies, but companies of any kind, right? Which shows that this is a trend that lots of people are finding attractive. And what I wanted to do was understand, well, what's motivating this and what are the implications of this? How do the teachers feel about this? How do the kids feel about it?
What is hyper-education, as you refer to it, doing to the classroom culture and to individual kids? Can you tell us about the stress levels among kids, even in elementary school?
You know, you could even go pre-elementary school. I was at a center where I saw a child in a diaper, right? So, but to your question more specifically, teachers I spoke to and principals and health experts, to some degree, they either are, say they're indifferent towards this or they worry about this. And they typically err on the side of worrying about what it's doing to the culture inside the classroom. I had a teacher say, like, I'm seeing kids who are just nonverbal, right? And this is a new trend. I'm seeing kindergartners who can't handle the stress of, you know, of filling the educational commitments of the kindergarten, which is kind of going up and up. And then also after school, having, you know, to do a math class and then do a violin lesson or then do some kind of, even just do sports, right? In all of these ways, our kids today are as many people would just call them, overscheduled. Okay, and parents today are spending more money on their kids than at any time in history. And what's impacting the inside of the classroom, teachers are seeing kids who, you know, may be quite good at the academic part, right, but just seem fragile, right, and don't seem to be very secure or at ease. And that's what's troubling the teachers. And then you're finding that as more parents do this, other parents feel the need to do it in order to keep up with those who are doing it. So this education arms race is starting. And so parents are saying, sorry, teachers are saying that they see kids who are doing just fine in school worried that they're not doing well enough because they see other kids doing better than them who are invested in these, you know, just after school programs. Again, these after school programs are as common as soccer and ballet or something else, right? They're all over the place and easy to do. You could be in karate and be in a math center. And that's just raising the stakes inside the school. And so the culture of the school is getting more competitive as parents seek out well-meaning parents, you know, well caring parents, thoughtful parents seeking out opportunities for their kids outside of school.
Pavan, how does this trend toward hyper-education expose and increase educational inequality?
Right. I think that's an excellent point. I mean, we all know that the quality of education to some degree depends on your zip code. And this is just making that all the more intense, all the more widening the gap, because you have families, these are typically middle-class families or higher-income families, who can afford to put their kids in these after-school academic centers. So it's like they can afford to put their kids in, you know, AAU baseball or AAU basketball. And it's creating, it's widening the gap between their kids' educational outcomes and abilities and others. And then you're even seeing, like, inside the same school, right, not just across towns, but even in the same school, you're seeing more educational inequality take place as some invest in this and others don't. And teachers, right, when you talk to them, they say this isn't always good for the students, right, to be, they don't necessarily learn the way they should learn if they're really invested in these after-school programs. But parents still believe there's a great outcome for this. And they're not in any way showing any signs of slowing down. Again, especially during this time of concern over how much are our kids getting out of school during with this remote learning, this is going to become even more of a new normal than it already was tending to become.
Pavan Dhingra is joining us on our program, talking with us on the Sunday Magazine. Hopefully you have nice plans on tap for this holiday weekend, a safe one for you and yours, and happy Memorial Day. Hopefully you're in good health as well. Pavan, what's morality got to do with it?
That's a great question. And the parents I spoke to, you know, so many of them said, surprisingly to me, that, you know, while teachers may be worried about the stress on the kids and what it does for them, we're worried what would happen to our kids if they don't do this. Not just in terms of their academics, but in terms of what kind of kids they would become. I spoke to parents who would say, you know, listen, my neighbors across the street, like, I see their son talk back to their parents and it's disrespectful. You know, or they're just entitled. They think that life is going to be handed them on a silver platter because their parents, you know, make middle class, upper middle class incomes. But that's not how life is. I want my kids to know you have to work hard for what you want in life, right? Which we all want our kids to realize that value. Okay. And for these parents and for a growing number of parents, it means let's put them in activities that aren't just fun, but that add to the kids' understanding that it takes hard work to get ahead. How do you instill that in kids? Right? It's not just a lecture that makes the kid realize that, oh, I have to work hard to get ahead. You have to be doing it, right? I had a friend who, like, my kids played a lot of Little League baseball. And I was talking with another friend of mine, and he was like, I want my son to be pitching. Not because I want him to pitch, like, you know, in high school down the road, but I want him to feel that pressure of everyone's looking at you and you're the one throwing the ball, right? And you can't simulate that. You have to be experiencing it to really kind of grow into that. And the same thing here. These parents want their kids to be in activities that are about working hard, that are about kind of what helping you down the road as opposed to instant gratification as a way of understanding these are the moral values you need to become a good person. I had parents say things like, you know, I look around my neighbors don't know their kids. Their kids are outside, you know, smoking weed or doing these other things. You have to be mindful of your kids, which is why I have them in this after-school math center as a way of reminding my kids, this is who we are. It was a lot of it was like, not just about, again, being academically prepared, but about growing into a certain kind of person. And I have a lot of stories around that, which were surprising to me.
How would you say the pursuit of hyper-education is gendered?
Mothers in particular I spoke to were very intentional about having their daughters involved in, for instance, math education outside of school, because they had seen the story, seen the statistics and heard the stories that, you know, girls, when they hit middle school, their confidence in math drops and their outcomes, their abilities seem to drop. And so these mothers were mindful of that and said, I don't want that to happen to my daughter. So I want them in this after-school math center so that they can, when they get to middle school, they have the confidence to handle it, right, and feel like I am good at this subject. So it's not just about what your abilities are, but it's also how you understand your abilities, right, with your own kind of narrative or thoughts about yourself. And by having girls in particular in these centers, it helped, according to the mothers, give them a certain kind of sense of, I'm good at math. I'm a math kid, even though, you know, it wasn't their first love. So when they got to middle school, they wouldn't see a drop, right? And one mother said, I don't want my daughter to be a mathematician. I don't care what she does. I just want her to have options and want her to have confidence. So it's about building up confidence, about building up opportunities for kids, less about, you know, grades per se, or about, you know, an SAT score, which is coming down the road, or something like that. And other girls I spoke to a lot of the girls and boys, and the girls I spoke to were saying, you know, we do this because, you know, we enjoy it, and we also don't want to be seen as just girls who are only interested in, like, how we look, or in our aesthetics, right, what we're wearing, and our hair. We want to be involved in other things too. So I'm involved in dance and I'm involved in this, and it kind of makes me a well-rounded person. And so girls took a lot of pride in their activities that were kind of unexpected to some degree.
How do the children that you interviewed and observed understand their participation and handle the reputation, often stigmatized, of being so academically minded?
Yeah, that's a really a great point to bring up. You know, there's a lot of concern around stress among youth, and that's very real. And part of that is the stress that students encounter is less because they have, you know, intense parents, which is what we typically think as being why they're stressed. But it's more, I think, because the parents and they, the girls themselves, the kids themselves, can value, like, doing well in these areas and being kind of excelling in academics. But that's not necessarily cool, right, according to their peers at school. And even teachers I spoke to. Sometimes youth would say their teachers don't even appreciate and can make them feel somewhat bad about their academic success. And so it's that disconnect, right, between what the kids want to take pride in, what the parents take pride in, and what the school seems to value, that created some sense of stigma and concern for students. So I was talking to parents who say, when you walk into a school, right, you typically see, like, the trophy cases right in front of you with all the sports trophies. Mm-hmm. That can be great, but what does that tell you the school values most? You know, it's valuing that. And if your kids aren't that kind of kid, then maybe your kid isn't going to feel as valued here, right? So parents were very sensitive to those kinds of things. And so stigma was one of the outcomes of doing very well in school. Right? Again, a lot of teachers applauded the kids, and some of the spelling bee kids and math kids that I spoke to said that their teachers were their coaches and their greatest champions, but it wasn't uncommon to hear concerns around how the school treated them, either the kids in the school or even the school culture, relative to their what they thought would be like their sense of pride, like, I'm doing academically well. Of all the places that should be applauded, this is the school, but that wasn't always the case, and that creates a sense of stigma. And when you're a 13-year-old, right, you know, that carries a lot of weight, right? Much more than it does at an older age or even a younger age. I mean, you know, that kind of middle school, elementary school, high school age.
What does focusing on the children of highly skilled professional Indian American parents tell us about both that drive toward hyper education and also the pushback against it?
Yeah, I mean, the parents I speak to, those who were of Indian and Asian origin, felt that, you know, this is something we need to be committed to, because this is how we're going to provide mobility for our kids. And then it becomes kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Because, well, if we're doing it, other people are doing it, we have to do it. And they're going to expect it of you, so you have to do it so you feel up, you fulfill the expectation of you. And the spelling bee was one avenue for this, as they saw a lot of their peers kind of excel in spelling and math or other things become kind of expected avenues to find educational success or mobility, right, or achievement. And so it kind of creates an expectation around this for the students, for the families, that if we don't do this, somehow we're behind, okay? And so you have, you know, immigrants comparing themselves to U.S.-born individuals, immigrants comparing themselves to other immigrants, U.S.-born individuals, you know, saying we need to catch up to the immigrants, everyone's comparing themselves to everyone else as they're trying to keep up with this new normal that's taking place across, you know, the New York City metropolitan area and metropolitan areas all over the country, whether it be Boston, D.C., San Francisco, Houston, Dallas. It's happening, like I said, it's, you know, these are some of the fastest growing companies in the country for a reason, right? This is a growing national trend.
I want you to share with us, because you had an interesting experience attending Spelling Bee competitions, both South Asian-centric and Scripps, where you volunteered as a word reader, among other roles. What are they like? What was it like being on the podium? What was that like for you?
Fearful, anxious, trepidation, sweat, you know, all of the above. Like, so so there are these spelling bees that take place for kids, obviously, and I went there to see kind of, you know, learn how, what's going on here. That's part of this kind of investment in education. And I volunteered to help out, and so this was a spelling bee that was for kind of older kids. Oh, I mean, not older kids, but like, there was a, they're like fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth grades. There's one for younger kids than that. And so I was a pronouncer. And so when you're pronouncing words that you don't know the meaning of, you've never even heard before, it's not only is that kind of daunting, but then the parents of the students are in the back of the classroom watching me, and they're allowed to, you know, object if they think a word gets mispronounced or something goes wrong, right, that gets their kid out of the competition. So I have parents who are staring at me as I'm, you know, trying to pronounce words that I've never heard before, so their kids can, like, spell them correctly and then kind of hopefully move on to the next stage of the competition. So I'm in the back, you know, before the competition starts, I'm in the back room. I found this app about how to pronounce words properly. So I'm typing in all these words. And, of course, some of the words don't even show up in the app because they're really complicated words. And so luckily I got through it without any – one objecting, although I would not have, you know, thought they were wrong to object. I'm sure I said some things, mispronounced some words, but the students got through it fine, and we all ended up, you know, having a good time. But I learned from there, stay in my lane, don't try to become a spelling bee or word pronouncer. You know, keep that for the experts.
A question I've been thinking the whole time that we were talking, and was thinking as I was reading through Hyper Education, why good schools, good grades, and good behavior are not enough. Interesting book. The author, Pavan Dhingra, who is a professor at American Studies at Amherst College, is talking with us on our program. I'm Bob Salter. This trend toward higher education, what does this have to do with what for years we've heard described as no child left behind, and this whole movement to standardize education?
Right. So no child left behind is obviously, you know, one of the most meaningful government programs in education in the past 20 years. And the premise behind it, right, is that we want to make sure that children who are not getting the same education or quality education as others need to, you know, they need to be accountable, have to be more accountable for teachers in schools. Okay. Now, what this led to in practice was, as you already alluded to, a big increase in assessment of students, right? So they are a lot more testing going on at the state level. And the families I spoke to, even though there's been a lot of pushback against No Child Left Behind for various reasons, including the testing that students have to go to and the teaching of the test, the parents I spoke to are not part of that critique. They think, yeah, students should be assessed. We should know how well our students are doing, how much they're learning. In fact, we don't think there's enough testing to some degree. I spoke to a mother whose child was in second grade, and in Massachusetts, the first test that you get is in third grade, first standardized test. And it's really, you know, something that students aren't even that made that aware of, but it happens anyway. But she was saying, we have to wait until third grade to find out how well our students are doing. That's too late. So I want my child in an academic competition so I have a sense of how they measure relative to other kids. Again, why? Well, school is competitive. And we may not want it to be, but it is. We have, you know, programs like Race to the Top, right? And we have grants that come out there, and Blue Ribbon Schools that highlight how great they are. Then we're basically saying, yes, school is competitive, and parents realize this, and then therefore they want their kids to be outcompeting others. And the whole college entry process is kind of premised on this idea of, you know, demonstrating superiority over other kids to get into the few slots for, you know, selective colleges. And so parents are responding to that as well, right? And so No Child Left Behind is kind of part of this whole story. In fact, No Child Left Behind gave billions of dollars to tutoring, right? Again, the premise here was like, well, if kids aren't doing that well in school, or they're in schools that are not performing well, they deserve tutoring. But what they ended up doing was giving billions of dollars to tutoring companies that have then kind of grew all over the country. They grew in legitimacy. They started partnering with education, with schools more. And so now you have parents whose kids are doing just fine in school who don't need tutoring saying, wait a minute, maybe I should take advantage of these tutoring companies too, right? And that's really seen the uptick. And that's what I look at. But again, these growing companies that are catering now more and more to middle-class, upper-middle-class families whose kids actually don't need tutoring to stay ahead, to keep up with grade level or to compensate for poorly performing schools. But this is the fastest growing kind of market for this. And that's what's creating this education arms race and facilitating this education gap that we're talking about.
Why is it that some people think that if they confront the concept of hyper education, that basically it's almost like they're confronting the whole notion of childhood?
Right. This is, I think, at the heart of it in some ways, right? Like, what kind of childhood do we want for our kids? Do we want childhood to be a time that is separate from adulthood, where you can be kind of carefree? It's about this enjoying your time, learning, playtime, discover what you like, take your time to enjoy those things and kind of nurture those passions, whatever those might be. Or do you want childhood to be a time that prepares you for the challenges of adulthood, that prepares you for the competitiveness of the next stage, that makes you feel that, you know, I have to be kind of succeeding and be productive at a young age, otherwise I may be left behind, right? That is kind of our fundamental debate right now around what we want out of childhood. And this trend that I'm speaking about is on one side of that discussion. These are families, and again, they're growing in number and they're well-meaning. They're not, you know, intense in ways that you may want to caricature, who are saying, you know, childhood is a time to be ready for the next stage of life, for adulthood. Adulthood is not easy. And if we don't prepare our kids now, if we let them just kind of have more, too much free time and too much screen time or too much anything, too much even just playtime, then we may not be doing them any favors later on, right? And this is what's in many ways worrying parents and what's kind of pushing them to do what they do. And it's part of a kind of a growing, you know, discussion, even divide in our country, right? Should we be slowing down? Should we have, you know, should we take childhood back in some ways? Or should we kind of think about it as a time to prepare our kids to do them, you know, give them the opportunities to be successful later? Of course, it's a false choice, right? Playtime and creative time are really essential, right, for growing as a child and for cognitive growth, for social developmental growth. But even if parents know that, they still want their kids in more and more education and more activities in general, because otherwise they feel that other kids will surpass them and they'll be left behind.
Pavan Dhingra, who is a professor of American Studies at Amherst College, the author of Hyper Education, Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough, books published by NYU Press. Certainly we wish you the best with this book and your future works.
I think that there's a few things. One is, it's so easy to caricature parents who are investing in education for their kids as being, you know, too intense, authoritarian, uncaring. I spoke to a school principal who said, parents who have their kids doing more long division outside of school are just uncaring. They're ungrounded. And I want, you know, that's a school principal who's saying, don't do more long division. And I want to dispel that. These are well-meaning parents. They're thoughtful parents. They're not single-minded. They have reasons for what they do. And I want to elucidate that. But the reason why I want us to understand that is that if we want to make progress in making childhood less competitive, if we want to make progress in making education a place that thinks about, you know, compassion, and creativity as much as it does assessing the ABCs, then we have to be able to look at each other in respectful ways and start that conversation. And that's what I'm hoping this kind of comes out of this, right? We can, I don't mind students being involved in education outside of school. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. But it becomes a problem if we're doing it just to make our kids more competitive, just to make them beat out others. Because then it creates a domino effect that involves, again, stress, right, anxiety, lack of confidence, all a lot of the themes that I heard teachers and others tell me about. But to get at past that, right, we have to realize why is it, what's motivating this, and have parents also understand why teachers and principals and guidance counselors are concerned about this. I spoke to college admissions officers, and I share their side of this and why they think this kind of investment in hyper education may backfire, right? But we're not going to get past it if we just think about them and these people who are doing it or those who are critiquing it as single-minded in their approaches, right? And so that's what I really want people to get out of this.
Pavan, what book is in the works beyond this one?
Well, I've been interested in this. Like this book currently, Hyper-Education, is about the pursuit of education outside of school, right? And so what does that look like? And so the similar theme is motivating me to think about where else we see education and learning outside of schools. Obviously, schools are central, but they're not. They have a lot of partners. And we need to recognize, because the partners in to schools are growing in importance and in their implications. So while hyper-education looks at these learning centers and these competitions, I'm also interested in how, for instance, libraries, on the other side of the coin, can be partners in education. What are they doing to facilitate education? And other kind of cultural centers, for instance, could be seen as partners in education. So I'm interested in what their role is in our collective kind of learning.
Thank you for joining us on our program.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
We're joined in this portion of our program. I'm Bob Salter, joined by Lyra Logan. Lyra is the author of an interesting new book. Now, this has a great title, Learn to Program with App Inventor. She is an MIT Master Trainer in Educational Mobile Computing, and she is joining us on our program to talk with us about a number of interesting ideas. You know, this whole idea of computer science education is something that has come up in the middle of December, the 9th through the 15th, actually, Computer Science Education Week, which is a perfect time to be talking about the whole idea of apps and the like. First of all, it's nice to have you join us on our program. Good morning.
Good morning, Bob. Thank you for having me.
A lot of things I want to ask you, but one of the first is this whole idea of computer science. Why is it so important for kids to have a basic understanding of that?
Because we are living now in, as everybody knows, a technology-driven society.
Really?
Where we're all, yes. Where we're all walking around with these small, super-powered computers, these smartphones. And, of course, there's social media and online shopping and the robots and IBM Watson from New York and just self-driving cars and just everything now, the Internet of Things. And we all need to know. We need to have a basic understanding of the power and impact of this field that's dominating our lives, this computer science field. And so that's the very first reason. We need to know how these things work. And we need to be able to sort of create with the technology rather than just use it. Because even if a child, and because we're not, you know, the proponents of computer science education for all are not saying that everyone is going to become a computer scientist, but we're saying that even if a child doesn't end up working in a technical field, it's likely that his or her work will involve some aspect of computers. So that's really another reason. And then I think finally, since technology is so dominant, computing jobs have become the number one source of new wages in the United States. And so that provides a great opportunity. And to know that our needs for skilled computing workers are not being met means that we really do need to expose more kids to computer science and hopefully strike a chord with them so that they will want to go on and pursue it. And so then we do need to be teaching it as early as we can to our kids.
Okay.
this brings up a natural point, because I think based on what you have just said, it's appropriate to ask, how early then do we start trying to teach kids, and how sophisticated does this get? Do we start going into things like coding?
So, yes, we start, first of all, we start in elementary. And we do start there's more to computer science than just coding, but coding is the part of computer science where programmers or people talk to the computers and tell them what they want them to do. So we do start in our programs in Florida, and many others start by teaching coding, but we don't teach it in the intimidating way that most people may think of coding, where you are sitting in a room at a computer typing lines and lines of unintelligible characters and code on the screen. We teach it using these visual programming environments like App Inventor, and there are many others where kids are not typing code, but they're dragging and dropping blocks of code to the screen, almost like piecing a puzzle together on screen to program games and animations and apps. And so in the book, Learn to Program It with App Inventor, App Inventor is a visual programming environment that makes it much easier, and that's why it's a good platform to start using to start to learn to code.
What happens if, for some reason, they just don't get it?
They usually get it, and because it's, like I say, it's fun and it's very easy. It's like snapping the pieces of a puzzle together. So it's kind of impossible not to get when you're using the visual programming environment, which is why we have started teaching kids to code with that, with those types of languages, as opposed to the typing that you could easily not get, because it's not easy to look at that code and understand it. And it's also not as fulfilling to sit for, let's say, an hour and type code, and then all you see on the screen is Hi World. Whereas with these visual programming environments, in an hour, you've got a fully functional game, you've got a fully functional app. And so it not only is it easy, but it's also engaging and encouraging.
In an hour, a fully functional game or app?
Yes. In fact, the other day for Computer Science Education Week, I went to, I was down in Miami teaching middle school students how to create the very first app in the book, Learn to Program with App Inventor, which is a type-free texting app. And they created the fully functional app in the 1 hour that I had with them. So that's the beauty of these types of programming environments, because it makes it quicker. The blocks combine lots of commands in one, what you would type several lines of code, the blocks contain in one block that you would put in. So you're still doing the thinking. You're still doing the creativity, the creative part of building the app. And you're figuring out the algorithm, which is simply a step-by-step plan, but you're not having to type all the tedious typing of all that code.
Mm. This whole idea of computer science and exposure to it, I mean, do a fair number of high schools even teach this?
Well, there was a recent report that came out, the State of Computer Science 2019, that shows that 45% of U.S. high schools are teaching computer science now, and that's an increase from prior years. And I think in New York State, 44% of your high schools teach it. And so it varies from state to state, but overall in America, it's 45% of the schools are teaching it, while 90% of parents want it taught. So
there's a little bit of a disparity there.
Yes. Caused mostly by the fact that we're still in the process of developing teachers to teach it. We just don't around the country have enough teachers who are qualified to teach it. So most of the districts are doing their best to, the school districts are doing their best to offer professional development, and colleges that are preparing teachers are doing their best to start adding computer science education components for their teachers that are graduating. But it's just taking time because there's so many schools and so many people needed to teach the subject.
Well, also, is part of the issue something that I was also going to bring up, and maybe I phrased my question earlier incorrectly when I was asking about the students and not getting it. What about those of us who are, let's say, a little bit more seasoned age-wise, in other words, older? Do older people at times tend to be more intimidated by this idea of coding? I mean, it's learning something new. And
right.
Many people, a barrier comes up immediately when, you know, some sort of change happens like that.
Right. I think folks who may be out of school, and then of course even older, like us, the baby boomers, may not necessarily be interested in learning anything new. And then some of us are, but also we may not be as adept with the technology that all of these kids are growing up surrounded by. So we may not see us. We do notice that these kids, since they're used to having phones and tablets and computers in their hands all the time, even though they're having them in their hands to use them, they seem to be, that may be one of the reasons why they easily adapt to now beginning to create with them instead of just using them. Whereas, you know, older people may not be walking around with a phone attached and playing games on the phone all day or as much as their parents will let them. So I think that is a reason why older people may be a little bit more intimidated by picking up and starting to create with technology.
We're talking on our program with Lyra Logan. She is author of a new book entitled Learn to Program with App Inventor. She is talking with us about this whole topic of computer science education. When we talk about computer programming, and we'll get into talking a little bit about the book in just a couple of moments, but what would you say are perhaps some of the biggest misconceptions about that we have?
I think the first is that because the code that you see is virtually unintelligible, that somehow it's a magical ability or an ability that's too complex for regular people like me to, you know, like me and you, we're just regular folks. We can't do that. It's something that you've got to be a scientist to be able to grasp. So that it's too complex or it's too hard for me. That's one of the concepts that the misconceptions that people have. And that's why I'm glad that more and more of these visual programming environments that are sort of a softer way to introduce folks to creating with technology, I'm glad they're available now. So that's one misconception, that it's just too hard. Everybody can't do it. The next one is that it's boring. And, you know, of course, that's going to be a personal determination whether or not you find something boring. But I always say that once you learn how to code, then you can create anything. And so it's kind of, when you think of it that way, it's kind of hard for that to be boring because you've just sort of opened the world up to yourself to create anything that you want to with, you know, just get to your computer and create anything. And then I think the last one is that it's lonely and solitary and that you're always working alone when you're a coder, when in fact, as a computer programmer or software developer, you're often working in teams and you're collaborating with your other team members who are working on the project or with someone who's hired you for the project or with people who are testing the app or project that you've created. And so it's not as lonely a pursuit as maybe some people think.
Your book, how do you see this, or do you see this, perhaps inspiring students to even want to get, but to sort of get prepared for an education in computer science and potentially careers in this field?
I think the first thing the book does, and it's certainly my first goal, was to demystify coding, to dispel some of those misconceptions that it's hard and that some people can't do it and some people can. So by taking students in the very first chapter through creating a fully functional app with cool mobile technology features like speech recognition and texting, it begins to instill confidence in readers that they themselves and everyone else can create their own working apps. And then it demonstrates how apps are created and the type of programming that a coder would use to create an app. So they learn that. And then it in a very fun and engaging way, it exposes students to the computer programming concepts that they will encounter in any language that they end up coding in if they go on in computer science, because these languages change. Way back when, it was Fortran was the language, and then there was C++, and now there's Python, and I code in a language called PHP, and so there are many languages, but they all have as a foundation the computer programming concepts that I'm teaching in each chapter of the book, with some really cool apps that use the greatest and the most fun mobile technology. So we've got games and a bus tracking app that uses GPS and the location sensor and a quiz app and even an app at the end where you take a selfie and then you can try on virtual sunglasses. So lots of fun and engaging projects that teach these great skills. And then after they create the apps, then I challenge them to go ahead and modify them, learning, you know, using what they've learned. So I believe they really leave the book knowing some computational thinking, like how to break problems down into small parts and solve them, and then also learning the core computer programming concepts.
I can't believe you actually mentioned a term that I was familiar with from my college days, Fortran. Oh, my goodness.
Yes, that was one of the very first ones I had ever heard about, the first language, and it really is true that from that language to all of the rest of them, Java and all of the rest, they have the same foundational computer programming concepts that make them work.
So, if somebody has an idea for an app, because often you hear somebody say, "Well, you know, you should do an app with that." What's the first step in bringing it to life?
So if I had an idea for an app, the first thing I would do is do some market research. And that may be that may sound a little intimidating, but I simply mean just go to the Google Play Store or the Apple App Store and just see, is it already out there? And is it out there the way is the app in that store the way you think it should work? And so if it is, then maybe I might not pursue it. But if it's not up there, if no one else has created the app, then I would sort of run with it. And what makes the App Inventor program so useful in a sense of sort of launching an app or launching a project is because you can create these apps so quickly with these fully featured mobile tech apps very quickly. So I would throw together a prototype, and then I would distribute it to my family and friends and see if it does what I think it does, and if they use it the way that I think they would, and if it seems like they would buy it, and if so, I would go ahead and make whatever modifications I learn from their feedback, and then go ahead and get it up on the app stores and sell it.
Lyra Logan talking with us on our program, and she is a certified web development professional. She directs pre-college computer science programs and summer coding camps for elementary, middle, and high school students. She's also the author of a book with the title Learn to Program with App Inventor. And there's a website at programwithappinventor.com. That's all as one word, .org. And she's been kind with her time in talking with us about this idea of computer science education and a little bit about the book as well. Certainly the best with the book. And thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us. Hopefully your words perhaps can provide some inspiration for some of the folks listening to us too.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Thanks so much for joining us on our program. I'm Bob Salter. Hopefully we'll see you at 6 o'clock next Sunday morning.